The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This morning I thought we might consider the matter of doubt. And this came to me for a couple of reasons. One is that thanks to the Chico Meditation Group, they've been selecting a topic to consider at their weekly meetings. They have one topic every month. And I went down the last 2 months, and I can't even remember when the months were, but the first one was faith, and the next month I came and the subject was doubt. And so I was thinking about doubt. This is from before the beginning of last month. And then I got to sit there for an hour, hour and a half discussion, and listen to them discussing how doubt appeared in their own lives and in the world. And of course, that awakened in me kind of a connection back to the fact that my early years, I don't know if this is true for everybody, but for me it was gradually increasing doubt. So I thought I'd start there, because doubt is such a personal thing. Each one of us have experienced it in our lives, but the one we can know is only ever our own. There are probably many faces of doubt, but the two major ones I'd like to talk about today are the kind of doubt that arises in relation to things in the world exterior to us. And the other, of course, is the one that looks right inside and focuses entirely on the self. I'm 70, which means that my formative years from, you know, starting perhaps in teenagerhood, when you actually start to look around at the world outside, outside the world of your own friends, your family, and so forth. The events in the world that affected me, and each of us, depending on our age, has its own set. You know, my early teenage years, when I did hear anything of the news, which I didn't too much because my grandmother really never listened to the news, but there was the news that you'd hear about my own fellow countrymen attacking children and people in the churches in the South. And you know how that all unfolded. That was the first thing, my first awareness of things that were going on outside me. And then my late teenage years, Vietnam happened. And so I spent from my college years and early adult years living in a world where on news every night you saw people being killed. And if you were someone like me who was not a particularly savvy person, having no idea why this was going on, knowing I didn't like it, and increasingly feeling an absolute sense of powerlessness, because this was a big machine that was working. I didn't like it, and there wasn't a thing in the world I could do about it. So I did what a lot of people do, which is kind of shut down. Starting when I was about 23 or 24, I stopped watching the news on TV. And from that point on, except randomly, I never did watch it. You know, I did have a newspaper, but I decided that the way to protect myself from that feeling of absolute powerlessness is all I can say. The feeling that it's all wrong, and that's just how it's going to be. Earlier in my life, I had cast aside the thing that many people cling to, which is a religious faith. You know, I started going to church when I was 11 or so. When I was 15, I realized that whatever was being taught, I couldn't find any relevance for it in my young life. And so I set the pattern for the rest of my life, I think, which is when you don't like something, what you do is walk out the door. Or you get rid of it and get a new one, or, you know. The other part of my reaction to the Vietnam War was that I grew up from that point on feeling ashamed to be an American. So all of the feelings that had arisen in result to the war, I then attached to all the institutions of my own country. And of course, a few years later, I got proved absolutely right, because then Watergate happened, you know. And, you know, it's funny, I had to go back when I thought about Watergate and just all what it stirred up in me. I realized I couldn't even remember what it was about, so I had to go back and reread exactly what all of those lies and deception and uncoverings were. So by the time I was 30, I had pretty much cast aside the idea that there was anything that was believable. I wrote down some words. I thought, this is kind of what described me by the time I was 30. Cynical, sarcastic, mistrusting, scornful. My world was pretty much, I guess I'm not alone, but pretty much there was us, you know, the people that agreed with me, and then there was them. And my stepfather didn't help because, you know, I grew up in Berkeley, and he said, well, you know, if you draw a circle around Berkeley that's 50 miles across, once you step outside that circle, you won't find anybody who you think fits in with us until you get way over on the other side of the country. Now, all of this may seem to have nothing to do with the Dharma talk that you would come to hear. But actually, it's things like this that pave the path that comes to this gate or to the gate of whatever place we walk in for the first time. Now, the other side of doubt, of course, is self-doubt. I'm a worm. What have I got? It's the focus on what's wrong with us. It's the focus on what we perceive as our own limitations. And again, like my 50-mile radius, we draw a little circle around ourselves that is the safety zone, and we don't step out unless we have no choice. You know, we do things we're good at, we spend our time with people we like, and if we realize what we're doing, we've created an entire world of them. People who something is wrong with. You know. Well, I mean, isn't that true, you know? I mean, the people that you don't like, it's because it's their fault. And if they were nicer, better, kinder, smarter, you know, whatever, then they would be us. Then I wrote down a list of things, which is how I would describe how I felt inside here when I was all alone, which actually is all the time, right? We're always all alone inside here. And I felt alone. The powerlessness, inability to shift anything, almost. And the idea that no one could ever comprehend what I felt. I was alone. I'm trying to think when the truth of what I'm going to say next actually shifted, but I grew up incredibly shy. I think I've mentioned this in talks before. You know, when I was a little kid, if a stranger came in the house, I spent the entire time they were there under the bed. I mean, even if it was for the weekend, you know, and I was shy, painfully shy, probably all the way up until, you know, 10 or 15 minutes into my professional life when I was doing a lot of things that helped break that down. So I was alone. I was fearful. I was terrified of death. I'd been terrified of death my whole life. You know, we're talking now, I'm in my 30s, 40s. If I thought about death, I would literally break out in a cold sweat in my bed, you know, which is usually the only time I thought about it because there were no other distractions. I had a very secure life. I didn't do anything daring. I made a nest. I lived in my nest. This all sounds really awful, doesn't it? But actually, if you saw me from the outside, you know, I had a career, I was successful, I had friends, I had a family, I had all of those things, but I didn't step outside any of that. So sometimes, unless I could prevent these thoughts arising, I could feel like life was passing me by. You know, I had a lot of skills by this time. I probably could have found a job, you know, with the Nature Conservancy in Indonesia or, you know, something exciting, or at least not so prescribed. Nothing adventurous was going on. You know, from the time I was in my early 20s, I didn't even really seriously travel anywhere till I was in my late 40s. I stayed close to home. Part of it was because, you know, if you're ashamed of being an American, you don't want to show your face. and overwhelming all of this is something which I think a lot of people experience, and that is here I am, I'm at the midpoint of my life, and it appears that this is it, because there isn't, you know, nothing is going to change. But even that I was willing to accept, because for me, you know, the safety and the security was the important thing. Now, we all have a story. We all have the things which inspired us or disillusioned us. We've all experienced doubt. Some of us react with a sense of entitlement. It shouldn't be this way. I deserve better than this. I deserve something more. And that if conditions weren't as they have been, I would have had something more. But I certainly deserve something more. Some of us think, well, you know, this is just exactly what I expected would happen. You know, what could, you know, how many people do you know who are caught in that kind of trap because of the doubts that have sort of built that up? Some of us, this wasn't me, but some of us feel roused to action. And so we go out and we're going, whatever it is that disturbs us, we're going to attack it and change it and so forth. But actually, that's no different it's still us and them. And if we're successful, we've won the battle. And if we're not, then the bad guys have continued to be in charge. Some people are kind of overpowered by all of these reactions to what actually it's what our own mind has created. Some of us feel overpowered by all of it. And sort of withdraw from the effort to do anything different. Some people continue to fight, perhaps even feeling like they're banging their head against the door, but they keep going. All I can say is that for me, what it came down to is this. Whether the problem is the world or if the problem is me, I don't know which one it is. And also, I don't know how to fix it. I don't know what to do. So here we are, and by this time I've reached the age of about 45, and that's when Reverend Master Jiyu appeared in front of me one weekend in San Francisco at a two-day class on Buddhism. Actually, I believe it was probably called Serene Reflection Meditation, which is why I was there. I thought I was going to a meditation class. I had no idea. And I've said this many times. Very early on, it had to be within the first half hour, hour of her talk, I heard her promise, and she promised that there was something much more than all of this whatever. There was something greater than us, but not separate from us, that there was a truth in this world, in this universe, and not only could we all know it for ourselves, she called it our birthright to know that. And I believed her absolutely. So then what? There it is. Fortunately, there was a priory around the corner from me, and there was a place to go and follow up on this. And one of the first things I found, reading some of the books, in the beginning of The Wild White Goose, Reverend Master Jiyu describes what was going on in her life that actually catapulted her across the world into a monastery that she never even visited before. And of course, she was a generation ahead of me. And so her conditions were the same as mine, only different. She had World War II. And she talks about why is there war and bloodshed? Why do some people live and some people die? Why am I still alive? And why are my friends dead? And so there she was, headed off to pursue the answer to her. I don't know if she would have called them doubts, but to her questions. I started just the same as all of you did. Having decided to pursue this path, we start by doing what's suggested, which is setting up a meditation practice for ourselves, practicing as regularly as we can, sitting every day if we can. We've been introduced to the precepts, and those start having an effect on our life. We start to examine our own actions, our own speech, our own thoughts. Whether we know it or not, that causes us to begin to try to drop the habits that are formed when we are affected by doubt. We stop so much defining in the world in terms of us and them, of what's being done to me, and we start accepting that actually somewhere in here there's something that we need to see. But you know, in the beginning, there we are, we're trying to do the meditation practice. If you're like me, I kept fleeing to books, hoping someone would describe what meditation would like, so I would know if I was doing it. You know, I'd go into the bookstore and go into the religious section and take the books down, go to the index and look under meditation. Because in the world that we come from, you can do things like that. You know, if you want to know about a subject, you can look it up. You can't do that when you start this practice. One sidetrack I got caught in, and this isn't just for the 8 years that I spent as a lay Buddhist, but it went well into my first few months here. Somehow I missed the message that the Buddha taught, that our practice is one that leads to the cessation of suffering. Somehow I thought that hopefully large and spectacular religious experiences were the things that led to the end of suffering. I don't know how I managed to get that in there, but it was years before I... And of course, you know, what did I do? I spent 12 years failing. Doubt can still easily arise in the midst of a path you've chosen. I had a spectacular moment here in my, spectacular to me, no one even knew it was happening except me. But in my early years as a novice, because, you know, I came from a background in, like in my work situation, when decisions or whatever would come down from on high, I would, the immediate posture is, well, I don't know, you know. And so I brought that along with me. One morning, the novices, novices who are my age may remember this, but we were called over to the abbot's house, who was our master, and it was coming on this time of year, and the time was going to be scheduled for us to take family visits. And so he told us, here we are, and this is what we could expect, and this is how much time, and this is what we should try to do when we were away. And then he said something which I can't remember, but which I understood as saying, we'll all be doing this year, but we kind of hope that in years, pretty soon, you won't need to go visit your family. Well, immediately it was like, and for the first time in my life, I said no. Because, you know, the doubt door comes down and you don't hear anything. And I just kind of mentally kept it up, because I thought, here I am, and if he's saying this, it must be for a good reason. I have no idea what it could possibly be, but let's just wait and see instead of reacting and doing whatever that leads me to. And sure enough, the next day we were back at his house. He said, I understand that some of you misunderstood what I was saying about this, and it wasn't at all what he meant. So, you know, the details of this are completely unimportant. But there comes a time in our life where we have to say no to the mind that immediately wants to exclude anything that challenges what we think is the world of right and wrong and good and bad and so forth. Wait. Wait and see. And of course, that's exactly what Reverend Master Jia was teaching. You know, I think we could all afford to engrave it, not just on our hearts, but probably, you know, on the top of our doors so that we saw it. And that is the magic words of, I could be wrong. I could be wrong. You know, how many times do we have to experience something where we think we know exactly what's going on and what was said, and that later we find out it wasn't like that at all? And we spend 24 hours being, you know, furious with a close friend who has offended us, and they say, what? You know, it's we do that. I could be wrong. There are two ways in this world that we can know things. And we talk about this a lot. We have a wonderful mind that knows how to do things, that can memorize things, that can figure things out, that can fix things, does all kinds of things for us. It classifies things, it organizes things. It discovers things. And when we doubt, that's what the mind is doing. We take whatever the experience is, we analyze it, and we put it in, you know, the wrong column. Probably not a good way to face things, but it's what we know how to do. The other way that we know things is what is often called the heart mind. The heart mind doesn't measure anything. It doesn't classify it. It knows things. It can know things absolutely. But no one else, you can't tell someone else what you know. You know, as we step into this practice and go down whatever, however the path goes for us, you know how it is that gradually, things, I don't want to say that they get better, but we see things in ways we haven't seen them before. Things may clarify. Things that people teach us, suddenly you say, whoa, everyone has Buddha nature. And you go, and then you think, wait, I've heard that, you know. But it's, you discover it as though it's new. I can remember going down the cloister here one day, grinning like an idiot. Someone said, what are you grinning about? And I said, every minute we get to start off fresh. It's like, you know, that's not a secret truth, it's, you know, but, and I'm sure I heard it 100 times, but in that moment, I thought I found it. Which is, of course, is what happened to the Buddha. You know, he sat down there and he found it. He didn't sit and make out lists of 4 things and 6 things and 8 things. There it was. And then you say, well, here it is. And then, how could I explain this? Well, there are a million ways. You know, how many ways can the Buddha's teaching be explained? But until we know for ourselves, we understand with that first mind. Let's see. courage. It takes a lot of courage to drop the safety that we think we've created for ourselves. So it's not courage that looks like much, but it means that in learning to trust the heart mind, we have to put down the armor and become soft, soft and vulnerable. So with the heart mind, how do we know? How do we know that whatever teaching we're hearing isn't a crock, as we often say, you know, about things? I'm not going to read this entire paragraph because it would take a long time, but you get the point of it very quickly. This is Great Master Dogen in his chapter. Entitled Refrain from All Evil Whatsoever. But this is his chapter on the three pure precepts: cease from evil, do only good, and he calls it purify your intentions, as I recall. Yes, purify your own intentions. And so he's talking about how do you cease from evil? He says, it is not that there are no evils. It is only that there are things that one should not do. It is not that there are evils. It is only that there are things that one should not do. It is not that evils are empty of substance. It is simply that they are things not to be done. It is not that evils do have a form, simply that they are things not to be done. Evils are not things that one should not do. It's not a list. They are simply things one does not do. And that's about a third of the way down the paragraph. And we all know what that means. I mean, from the time we were a little kid and we knew we'd done something, you know, you kind of try to get out of the room because you know, we all know. And that knowing that we experienced as a little kid is the same knowing. The other teaching that is commonly referred to when we talk about how do we know what is true. And that's the first, well, I don't know what, it's one of the early sutras from the Buddha, the Kalama, is that how you say it, sutra? Where, you know, the way people usually speak about it is you prove things true for yourself. And in that sutra, they're talking about if you follow the practice, does it lead toward the good? Does it lead toward the bad? That's how you know. I would like to close by reading a couple of things from this book. This is not a Soto Zen Buddhist book or even any Buddhist book. But when I ran into this passage, well, it's two passages that are in the book, I thought it was a really beautiful, they both are a beautiful explanation of what it means to say that we understand things with the mind, which is the realm of doubt. By the way, faith is not the opposite of doubt. Faith can hold doubt. How we understand things with the mind and how we understand things with the heart mind. And this book is written by a man who teaches physics at MIT, I believe, and he also teaches literature. For many years, a family of ospreys lived in a large nest near my summer home in Maine. Each season, I carefully observed their rituals and habits. In mid-April, the parents would arrive, having spent the winter in South America, and lay eggs. In early June, the eggs hatched. The babies slowly grew as the father brought fish back to the nest, and in early to mid-August were large enough to make their first flight. My wife and I recorded all of these comings and goings with cameras and in a notebook. We wrote down the number of chicks each year, usually one or two, but sometimes three. We noted when the chicks first began flapping their wings, usually a couple of weeks before flying from the nest. We memorized the different chirps the parents made for danger, for hunger, for the arrival of food. After several years of cataloging such data, we felt that we knew these ospreys. We could predict the sounds the birds would make in different situations, their flight patterns, their behavior when a storm was brewing. Reading our osprey journals on a winter's night, we felt a sense of pride and satisfaction. We had carefully studied and documented a small part of the universe. Then, one August afternoon, the two baby ospreys of that season took flight for the first time as I stood on the circular deck of my house, watching the nest. All summer long, they had watched me on that deck as I watched them. To them, it must have looked like I was in my nest, just as they were in theirs. On this particular afternoon, their maiden flight, they did a loop of my house and then headed straight at me with tremendous speed. My immediate impulse was to run for cover, since they could have ripped me apart with their powerful talons. But something held me to my ground. When they were within 20 feet of me, they suddenly veered upward and away. But before that dazzling and frightening vertical climb, for about half a second, we made eye contact. Words cannot convey what was exchanged between us in that moment. It was a look of connectedness, of mutual respect, of recognition that we shared the same land. After they were gone, I found that I was shaking and in tears. To this day, I do not understand what happened in that half second, but it was one of the most profound moments of my life. And so this is a book about the universe, you know. He has something else in here, which is, he's quoting from a book by William James. And this is one where someone is recounting an experience, which is really the same as the one with the ospreys. It's experienced with the same mind, except this is someone who's speaking from a religious perspective. This person has a Christian background. I remember the night and almost the very spot on the hilltop where my soul opened out, as it were, into the infinite. And there was a rushing together of two worlds, the inner and the outer. It was deep calling unto deep. The deep that my own struggle had opened up within, being answered by the unfathomable deep without, reaching beyond the stars. I stood alone with him who had made me in all the beauty of the world, and love and sorrow and even temptation. I didn't seek him, but felt the perfect union of my spirit with his. Since that time, no discussion that I have heard of the proofs of God's existence has been able to shake my faith. Having once felt the presence of God's Spirit, I have never lost it again for long. My most assuring evidence of his existence is deeply rooted in that hour of vision, in the memory of that supreme experience. And I'll tell you one last thing before I go. When I read this first one, myself the first time about the birds, I remembered something that had happened to me I'd completely forgotten about. Hadn't thought about it in years. Probably must be 20 years ago now. I was on my way up from the Bay Area to come up here to the Abbey. And I was driving along I-5 on a warm afternoon. And you know how when you're driving along the freeway, quite often there are flocks of, I don't know what they are, blackbirds, starlings, somethings, but they're always right along the side of the road. And quite often when a car comes by, they're frightened and they come up and they head off into the fields. This time, what I had always dreaded actually happened. The flock flew up and right in front of my car. And one of them hit the windshield right in front of me. I heard it hit. And in an instant, I saw something. I saw the body drop, and I saw something separate. And I was all alone in the car, and out loud I said to myself, just because I said, I saw that. I don't know what it was, you know, and as I mentioned, I've forgotten about it. But mysteriously, my death terrors started to decline after that time. I have no idea. But doubt doesn't need to be a permanent shackle. Thank you.